Good evening. Thank you for coming. My name is Alan Pally. Tonight we have the great pleasure to present on this beautiful evening with a beautiful audience two titans of the theater who are also very close friends to this library. The last time Marion Seldes appeared on this stage was 3 years ago in a celebration of the work of the great director Margaret Webster. On that program, as a tribute to Webster's landmark production of Othello, Marion sang the Willow Song in as exquisite a performance as has ever taken place on this stage. Marion will be back here April 28th in the concluding program in our Katharine Hepburn series. By the way, we're expanding our email list, so do add your email to the list outside the auditorium when you leave. Edward Albee's last appearance on our series took place in 2000 on the centennial of the death of Oscar Wilde. Edward spoke about Wilde and read The Color of His Hair, A.E. Housman's tribute to the Irish poet. I also want to thank Edward for introducing me to Mel Gussow and Larry Sacco, two great men, sadly no longer with us, whose generosity and hard work have enriched our programs immeasurably. Please welcome Marion Seldes and Edward Albee.
Turned into an opera star. What are you doing next? You're doing the daughter of the regiment?
Yes, but not playing the part.
No, I didn't think that. But still,
you're not singing.
Now you're an opera star.
Yes, I am. I like to be in this Lincoln Center area, you see. They left out the gypsy in me. I don't like to go all around. I like to be around where I live, and so I'm here. This evening is for you to find out what Edward Albee wants you to find out about him. But because I think his opinions on almost every subject will fascinate you. But I have also got a kind of a present for Edward. We do these things together sometimes. Usually, not when Alan is introducing us, they say, Marion Seldes and Edward Albee. And we look at each other
And leave.
So, but even before I ask Edward anything, I would like to read some words about him from another playwright, because when I read them, they meant so much to me. I have them with me because I have a friend who's writing a book about Tennessee Williams, and he knew him so well, and he talked to him about Edward. And these words are the words from Tennessee about you. I don't think you've ever heard them. You couldn't have heard them. The love that I feel for Edward Albee extends far beyond his work, and I think that his is the most extraordinary talent to emerge in the last 30 years. I have admired other plays, but his work is emotionally dangerous and stunningly beautiful. I can't think of any other writer who has managed to combine the lean and the lapidary. He understands to a shocking degree the ravages both of love and love denied. He can identify the folly of the one and the cupidity of the other. His command of language is far beyond me. My words come from some instinctual dictionary that responds to fear and rage. But he has a full command of the language and can therefore achieve more with less effort. Can I read one more paragraph? Are you liking it?
Yeah, but you know, I'm fascinated because Tennessee could have been writing about himself.
You can see that I feel it is important that his work be studied. His work from which you can learn, but the love of which I speak derives from the fact that Edward remains the only playwright who truly acknowledged me and my work. And that is a great honor, especially considering his greater abilities. That I should have been noticed by this man of some aid means a great deal to me. While others write my obituary and perpetually recalculate my worth and my gifts, he has always been loyal in his respect, and he has waved me across some rocky seas. Isn't that a beautiful thing?
You know what I think Tennessee was writing about there at the end about that? He was writing, I think, about my reaction to Camino Real. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting. Tennessee had a big, wonderful career going, and then all of a sudden, some of the critics started saying, well, you know, he's writing the same play over and over again, repeating himself. Why doesn't he do something different? So Tennessee occasionally listened to critics a little bit too much. He said, well, I better do something very different. So he wrote a fascinating experimental play that I loved a lot called Camino Real.
I loved it, too.
And you know what the critics said when that opened? Why doesn't he do what he knows how to do?
Well, a lot of people want Edward always to write Virginia Woolf again.
Oh, Son of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Yeah. Virginia Woolf 2, of course.
Of course. Yeah.
You give them Tiny Alice and they're sort of upset.
Edward.
Yes, my dear.
If you had an audience like this and just had some subject and topic you wanted to talk about, what would it be?
Making sure that we don't have to put up with another more than 1 year of a Republican administration. I've never seen our democracy more threatened from within in my entire life.
No, it's terrifying, isn't it?
You know, he wasn't even elected. He got in by a coup d'etat. And nobody paid any attention to it.
No.
Oh, well. We'll get rid of him. Though the terrible thing is, since he wasn't elected, I have this in my nightmares, since he wasn't elected the first time.
Oh, my God. He could run again?
He's only been elected once. But, of course, he'd only get 7 votes, so that would be all right.
It's odd, though. On any subject, Edward is honest. He's the most honest person I've ever known. So you have to be careful what you ask him. Very important. Edward, talk a little about your teaching, because I think that's the thing that in people who live in New York know least, about your teaching playwrights and going to colleges and that kinds of thing. Would you?
Well, I spent 15 years teaching at the University of Houston, where I learned so much about teaching. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting. But I want to tell you first about the first time I taught. This was in the late 60s, and I didn't know much about anything about anything. You know, I'd written 4 or 5 plays. But City College in New York asked me if I would teach a semester on 20th century drama. I said, okay. What they didn't tell me was that this was during something called open admission, which meant that anybody could show up. I mean, whether they'd gotten through school or not, and most people were just pushed from one grade to another to make room for the next crowd anyway. You didn't have to have graduated from anything to turn up in this class. And so I did my homework, and I made a whole list of the playwrights that I was going to talk about, the important 20th century playwrights, you know, Chekhov and Pirandello and Brecht and Beckett and the essential guys. 20th century drama. Well, I got there, and they were perfectly nice people, all different ages and sexes and degrees of what, I don't know. And I discovered two things very, very quickly about this, in the reaction to this course about theater in the 20th century. Most of them had never been to the theater. And most of them only had a vague idea of what the 20th century was. What to do? But I did notice that they were going to movies a lot. And it was very fortunate because a number of first-rate plays have been made into first-rate movies. Nobody ever gets to see them, but they're there. So I turned the thing into a movie course. And they liked that a lot. But then the real problem started. At the end of the semester, I was supposed to give an exam. Well, I said, well, I'm going to make it easy. Two questions. The first one was something terribly simple, I thought, like compare and contrast the methods of Ibsen and Chekhov.
We all know that.
When I read them the questions, they looked at me as if I had struck them very hard in the face. And they tried to answer these questions, but apparently in the schools they'd gone to, that they had not been taught how to put sentences together. I was appalled by the terrible education that these people had been given. And it's no better now, by the way. The public school education in this country is appalling. Maybe no more than 5% of the kids that go to public schools in this country get a halfway decent education. The rest are just shoved through, especially in the inner cities. It's absolutely disgraceful. And of course, how do you define a culture? You define a culture through its arts, don't you? The one thing that is not taught in our public schools anymore, the arts. Leave no kid behind, leave culture behind. But leave no kid behind and make sure they know how to make money and how to do business. Anyway, I got through that and I had a pretty good time.
Edward, what was the second question?
I can't remember. I really can't. But they looked at me with such horror at the end of the first one that I can't remember what the second one was. Anyway, eventually I was invited by the University of Houston to teach a playwriting course there. Of course, I knew perfectly well that you can't teach playwriting. I mean, you can't teach somebody who is not a playwright how to be a playwright. You can teach somebody who's not a playwright how to imitate other playwrights, but you can't teach them how to be a playwright. And I made a couple of conditions. I only wanted to do one semester. I'd been to Houston before, and I knew that the spring is the only human time in Houston. It rains all fall. There's a law that the temperature must be 107 in the summer, and as must the humidity be. And the spring is the only good time. And I also said, I want to choose my own students. And a number of the people there thought this was a very bizarre thing to want to do. I said, no, I want to teach people that I can learn something from and whose mistakes are interesting. And we can have a good cooperative time. So they finally said yes, which meant that the 15 years that I was there, Lanford Wilson took over for me, by the way. Yeah. And Lanford's not doing it now, but I think Charles Mee is going to be there next year, which is nice. He's a good playwright. The only problem with choosing your own students is you have to read the manuscripts that they send you. And so every winter, I received a huge carton of about 150 of 200 plays. Now, we all know that all plays are not very good. That some are worse than others and some are better than others. But it was a bit of a trial. But I managed to find each year 10 scripts that I thought, you know, these people, though they're making terribly interesting mistakes, but, you know, intuitively, these people are playwrights, and this is something that I can learn from and maybe do some good. So I did that for 15 years. And I did it in the Socratic method. I spent most of my time not talking, but answering questions, asking questions rather, and getting them to answer the questions about their intention, why they did this and why they did that. And as a result, I was learning more and more about being a playwright myself. And it was enormously instructive. And they seemed to get something from it, too. A number of them dropped out and never wrote a play again. But others have gone on and are having a rather good career.
Don't you think it's interesting that when a young playwright is reviewed in the New York papers now, 9 times out of 10 they mention Edward's name? I see it all the time.
Because this bewilders me. You know, people say to me, go see this play. Boy, was he or she influenced by you. So I go see the piece. I don't get it. I don't see it at all, you know.
But, well, I think they think of it as a compliment, Edward.
Are you saying something?
Can you put the mic a little closer? We're missing something. Oh,
is that better?
Oh, well, they're asides, darling. No, you must tell us. You can call out louder. We'll be careful. Thank you. All right. I was wanting to say something else from this manuscript I've got in front of me. These are.
You know, one more thing about Tennessee. Toward the end of his life, he wrote a number of plays that are barely performable. Mm-hmm. That he wrote 8 or 9 different versions of and then mixed them all up. But even at his least, Tennessee had an extraordinary gift.
An
amazing talent for language, an amazing talent for involving us.
Yes, and he was...
And I thought it was shameful the way people were treating him.
Yes, I was going to say they wrote him off, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
Yeah.
And a lot of playwrights, it happened to Arthur Miller in a way, too. And there's
yeah, but Arthur wrote a lot of interesting experimental plays toward the end of his life. They both moved away from the kind of naturalism or poetic naturalism in Tennessee's case that they were famous for.
But Edward, can I tell something sort of on you or on me?
Yeah, sure.
When we were rehearsing in Woodstock, New York, for 3 Tall Women before it had ever been done before in America. It had been done in Germany, but it hadn't been done here.
Austria.
In Austria, excuse me. Yes, of course. I was standing on a sort of a porch and rehearsing my lines, and the neighbor in the house next to me said, "What are you doing?" And I was embarrassed, and I said, "Oh, I'm learning a part in a play." "Oh," he said, "what play is it?" I said, "It's a new play by Edward Albee." And he said, "Oh, is he still alive?" Now, that's really being written off.
There was that interesting period in my writing career. Everything was fine through Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Everything was fine, but then I didn't write Son of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I wrote Tiny Alice and other apparently fairly obscure plays that the critics had did not want me to write. And so I started getting worse and worse reviews. And eventually I just couldn't get a production in the commercial theater in New York because, I closed rather quickly wherever I opened. And a lot of people did think that I had died. I was being performed in Europe and all over the rest of the United States, but I wasn't being done in New York. And apparently you learn that if you're not being performed in New York City, you're dead.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to... These words that I'm reading from, and I hope you're interested in them, it's like a secret diary, really. They're recorded by a writer named James Grissom, and his book about Tennessee will come out next year called The Follies of God. And he shares these with me, and I love them. And I'm going to say a few more words about Edward and then about another person that Edward and I both revere. Edward not only allows me to dream of what the theater is capable of doing for and to us, He allows me to dream of what literature, the very nuts and bolts of writing, can do for us, for the theater, for our great glands of salvation, which are strategically placed across our bodies and which are willfully neglected, empty, unused, ignored by most of the people who bother to string a few words together. My God, he can enrage me. Happily, the utter ugliness of the human spirit when it is desiccated or denied or denuded. There's a trinity for you to study. The valor of even the lowest desires when they are used in the act of survival. If I look back at my work, and I do, warily, I find that my characters often went for fists and blowtorches to hurt and destroy a character, a weak, an idea, a weak second act. But Edward has let loose in his garden a long, brilliantly scaled serpent whose teeth are blindingly white ivory, its venom a serum of truth, and his characters are bitten by this gorgeous emblem of evil, and then possessed of a supernatural vision that reveals everything. And even when the truths that revealed are ugly, the language is buffed to an eerie sheen. Aren't those images extraordinary? Do you like that?
Yeah, I like that film. I like that eerie sheen.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah. I've always thought Edward had an eerie sheen.
We do. Some nights more than others.
Edward, about directing, I think, because this is, although I've been directed by you and you've directed often, I think the public is just beginning to realize how much you do direct. And do you enjoy it? What is it like for you?
I should tell you the first time I directed. I had written my first play, The Zoo Story. And, I thought that I could just automatically direct. Since when I write my plays, while I'm writing them, I see them and I hear them as a play being performed in front of me while I write them. And I have a pretty clear vision of what they should look like and what they should sound like. So about a year after The Zoo Story opened, I thought, you know, I'm going to direct this thing. It's mine. Nobody can stop me. And fortunately, this happened deep in the foothills of western Pennsylvania, where I directed a production of The Zoo Story that was, without question, and remains, the worst production of any play of mine I have ever seen, including two in West Texas. It was quite clear that the author, me, didn't have the vaguest idea what the play was about. Or if I did have some idea, I was totally incapable of transforming this idea into the minds of the characters. It was just awful. They got through it, including a wonderful Afro-American actor named Terry Carter.
Yeah.
Yeah, who went into television and had a rather big career for himself there. They got through the production just by paying no attention to me, just abandoning me, which was the only way they could get through it. It was a decent production. And then it occurred to me there might be some craft involved in directing, and I'd better study it a little bit. But I wasn't going to go to famous director's school, you know, one of those things on the back of a matchbox or anything. But I did notice that a number of directors around the world were beginning to direct my work. And so I would go around and sit in and watch them. Now, none of these people minded. They had splendid egos of their own and huge talents. So they said, yeah, come on, sit in, learn. So, of course, I was watching Alan Schneider direct my work and Beckett's work in New York. And I was watching Peter Hall direct my work in London, and Jean-Louis Barrault directing it in Paris, and Franco Zeffirelli directing it in Italy, and various other worthies directing it in other countries. And that became the directing school that I went to. And I learned a number of very interesting things about directing that had never occurred to me, that there are very few things that can be directed in the same way that there are very few things that can be acted. And I've been making the mistake in thinking about directing is sitting around and telling the actors all about the symbols and the metaphors in the play and what the play was about. And then I finally realized the only thing that can be acted, metaphor can't be acted, symbolism can't be acted, meaning can't be acted. The only thing that can be acted is the moment-to-moment reality of what is happening to the characters in the situation that they're in. And then it occurred to me, you know, really that's the only thing that can be directed too.
But Edward, you've just put in one phrase the whole Stanislavski method.
Yeah,
isn't that true, those of you who are actors and are interested in acting? The moment-to-moment reality, that's the phrase, isn't it? Mm. It's interesting, too, when you are being directed by him, he will say to you, you can ask me anything. He said that to the young actors in the play about the baby. He said, ask me anything. And so they'd ask him, and they'd say, it's in the text. And of course, it's funny when I say it, but I think, of course, every answer is in the text. If you're fortunate, as I am, to work with living playwrights, and you can ask them, that's fine. But I think more than anything, it's that having the man who or the woman who wrote the play there is like a, is like the most perfect test you could ever get. It has nothing to do with the result. It has nothing to do with reviews. It has to do with the moment-to-moment finding the person he saw in his mind's eye when he wrote. And if you ever would get even a look of pleasure from him, that was enough. He doesn't dispense too many compliments, my dear.
That's because you guys are good. You don't need them. If you hire somebody as good as you guys, they don't expect compliments because they know they're good.
That's not
and they shouldn't be doing bad stuff anyway.
No.
But you know who I learned more about directing from and more about playwriting from than anybody else I've directed? It's by directing Sam Beckett.
Because
I've directed several of his plays. I've directed Crap's Last Tape and Happy Days and Ohio Impromptu and a couple of others. Boy, do you learn a great deal about playwriting by directing that man. Mm-hmm. And you learn a great deal about the clarity and simplicity mm-hmm. and purity mm-hmm. of the way the man thinks when he writes. Mm-hmm. There's a moment in Crap's Last Tape, I believe, or is it in Happy Days? It doesn't matter. In Happy Days, where Winnie has a sentence, and then the stage direction is a two-second silence. She has another sentence. And there's another stage direction, a three-second silence. I looked at that very, very carefully, and I said to myself, I wonder if I put the three-second silence first, will that be okay? And so I tried that with the actor. No. He could hear the difference between a two-second silence and a three-second silence. Because Beckett knows maybe more than any playwright, maybe even more than Chekhov, that a play is sound and silence.
Yes, yes.
And the silences are just as important. He knew a great deal about classical music, too. I tell my playwriting students, you must know everything about classical music. Because writing a play is a work of literature. It's also a visual experience, mm-hmm. dance and painting, but it's also a piece of music. It is a heard experience. Yeah. And being able to get the rhythms, the proper rhythms of a Beckett play is so revealing.
Isn't it interesting, too, that when you are being directed in a Beckett play, the thing you're asked most to do is not to act.
And unless you happen to be doing it at the Brooklyn Academy of Music a few months ago.
God help us all. Well, but I couldn't
resist saying it. It was such a dreadful production, no matter.
It's interesting, too, how certain actors, well, to me, almost every actor in the American theater who's been fortunate to act in Edward's plays takes a step forward every time he does, because he's studying directing and we're studying playwriting at the same time we're being actors in his plays. And one of the most wonderful experiences in my life was to be around the production of Tiny Alice. I didn't know that the critics didn't like it because I loved it. And I stood by for Irene Wirth. And I could watch it develop.
Did you ever go on?
Yes, I did.
Oh, good.
I did indeed.
Did I see you?
Yes.
Oh, good.
And you thought it was wonderful.
I'm not surprised.
But it had so many marvelous sort of complementary elements to it. John Gielgud was an actor that I had, the first play I was ever in New York, he directed. He's a very good director and a wonderful actor. And then Irene, well, Irene, she finally, the Irene went away, didn't it? No, but when she lived in London, she was called Irene Wirth, but she called herself Irene Wirth. And I thought...
Well, that wasn't her real name, of course.
No, Hattie...
Zimmerman?
No. Funny name. Do you ever remember? I used to be able to say it. Someone will say it while we're talking.
But Irene Wirth is a much better stage name.
A beautiful word. But I wanted to... I want always to say what I feel about Edward, and I don't want to be embarrassing and fulsome and say too much, but if I could have said the things that she said to Jim Grissom, I would be so proud.
Who, Irene?
Yes. Huh? He interviewed so many people, darling.
Nobody tells me.
Because he was working on this book about Tennessee, mm-hmm. And of course Irene was wonderful in Tennessee. Now, I'd like to read this because I think it's wonderful too. Edward Albee and Tiny Alice came into my life as I approached the age of 50, that age when John Gielgud asked me of my most important lesson. I turned 50 having had the brilliance and the caring of Edward as well as John, who never appreciated his understanding of or contribution to his role as the cardinal, but who allowed me, in ways far superior and far greater than our director, to expand the role of Alice. To be appreciated and respected and looked up to as someone who could help others in the theater was my dream, and it came to me, this secretive dreamer, at 50, in Tiny Alice, by Edward Albee. Edward is dark and mysterious and funereally funny, as am I, Ebed, he would say. I did not know that I would come to love him. I loved his work already, and I was enamored and confused by Tiny Alice, but I trusted it as both beautifully written and beautifully realized. Just one more paragraph, darling. Is this okay? Can
yeah,
I go on?
Yeah, sure.
I stood on stages and I said and I lived and believed their words, their worlds, and I grew as an actress and a woman by giving myself up to their greater art. This is also true of T.S. Eliot and Graham Greene and other writers I have worked with, certainly with Ibsen and Chekhov. Tennessee was so right when he told you that a complete devotion to, a total love of anything would be rewarded, and I found it in the theater, most fully in the works of Edward Albee. Then Jim, he very rarely puts himself in these pieces, but he said, I then told Irene that Ten had valued the work of Edward Albee above all other playwrights in the last 30 years of his life. Irene's eyes filled with tears, and she was barely able to utter the last sentence of our conversation. And I was there for it. I was there. Isn't that beautiful? And I think that's what actors feel about Edward. I mean, we feel this gratitude of the experience. It does change your life, you know, to be in a wonderful play by a great writer.
Irene was extraordinary playing Beckett also.
Yes.
Beckett. That's how I judge an actor.
Yes?
Basically, whether they can play Beckett.
Yeah. It's because of Edward that I played Beckett. But I want to, if your play hadn't been done with Crap's Last Tape, what was the first Beckett play you ever knew of or read of or knew about?
Oddly enough, it was Crap's Last Tape.
Yeah.
In that performance in West Berlin in German. That was my first experience of Beckett. Yeah. And even though I didn't understand a word of German, I understood what was going on in my play, sort of. But I think even more I understood what was going on in the Beckett play.
Really?
Yeah, because he's such an extraordinary visual playwright.
Yes.
As well as merely words.
And the whole thing with the tape machine was so original then, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It was so odd and fascinating. And everything he did. And I thought Donald Davis was so extraordinary in America.
Donald was a wonderful Canadian
beautiful actor. Beautiful actor.
Never quite realized. Was never realized of the talent that he was.
No. Well, it's hard in America, isn't it?
I tell anybody who wants to be in theater, and I'm sure you'd agree with me here, that if it's what you must do, mm-hmm. it's the most exciting thing you can possibly do. Mm-hmm. But I always tell my students, if there is anything else that you can do that will make you a complete person,
Do it.
Because playwriting, theater is tough. Yeah. Virtue is not its own reward.
No.
And it's really tough, but nothing can be more gratifying if it's something you have to do.
Yeah. And it's odd when people ask you for advice. I wonder how many of you have had advice that changed your lives or made it work. I've never gotten any advice that helped me. My life helps me. No, you know what I mean. It's the process of your life that advises you, I think. And someone else's opinion of what you should do with your life, I don't think works very much. Do you?
No. I began writing as a poet. I began writing poetry when I was 8, 9. Stopped when I was 28 or 29.
After you went to sea?
Well, I got some advice.
But please tell who it is.
Well, I discovered that W.H. Auden had moved to Greenwich Village, and I had moved to Greenwich Village after getting thrown out of college and thrown out of my adoptive home. And I'm a poet too. Hey, I better go see Auden. So I found out where he lived, and knocked on his door. He was there, and I thrust my poems at him, about 30 or 40 of them. I said, "My name is Edward Albee. I write poems. Please read them. I'll be back in a week." I went back a week later, and he hadn't taken the opportunity to move, which you'd think any sensible person would have. And he was home. Maybe he never went anywhere. And he invited me in. And I was 19, you know, you dare anything when you're that age. And for the next couple of hours, he went over my poems with me, you know, being helpful and pointing out my excesses and my lapses and things. And then he said, "What I really think you should concentrate on, for a while at least, as a poet, is writing pornography." Because Whiston himself wrote pretty good pornography.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he did. Yeah. The other writer, when I was visiting a friend of mine, when I was in my early 20s, visiting a friend of mine in the McDowell Colony, I discovered that there was a short, balding, mustachioed man wandering around the place. And I knew who he was, even though he wasn't a poet. I was still writing poetry, and I always traveled wherever I went with a small suitcase filled with my poetry. I mean, you never know when it's going to come in handy.
You want to thrust to that.
And so I ran into this guy, and I went into my act. I had poems with me, and I thrust them at him, and I said, "My name is Edward Albee. I'm a poet. Read these." And the next day, he trapped me somewhere, and he said, I've read these poems, Albee. I want to take you out and get you drunk. Well, you know what I thought had happened since the experience with Auden? I thought that my poetry had undergone such a glorious sea change that it could not be experienced sober. But that's not what this man, whose name was Thornton Wilder, had meant. He took me out, and we sat by one of those little lakelets that dot the New Hampshire countryside, and he brought a bottle of bourbon with him. And as the sun was setting, and as the level of the bottle of bourbon was declining, I remember remembering, that every time he finished examining and discussing one of my poems, he set it afloat. On the pond, and by the time he'd finished, the entire surface of the pond was covered with my work. And he said, Albee, I've read all these poems. I said, well, yes, I can see, there they are. I've read all of these poems, Albee. Pause, three dots. I think you should write plays. Now, this was, 8 or 9 years before I wrote a play. Aside from the three-act sex farce I wrote when I was 12, which we don't need to go into. I didn't know much about farce, and I knew even less about sex, but I wrote. Now, my knowledge of sex, at least in those days, was singular, but.
language.
But, I don't think Thornton Wilder was really thinking, he didn't really care whether I became a poet, a playwright or not. I think he was trying to save poetry from me. And he did it. So those were two very good pieces of advice. Think pornographically and write plays.
Well, I think your pornography is wonderful, Edward. Excellent. In every moment in your plays.
Thank you.
So funny when you said remembering it. That's a phrase in Three Tall Women that I love, that the young woman says. Edward, can I ask you another question that I've never asked you before? Did you ever consider or want to be an actor when you were young?
I acted my way through prep school. I was adopted by a wealthy family who sent me to very, very good private schools. So I got a great education, including by some teachers who realized that I had some kind of creative impulse, and they kept pushing me in the direction of looking at paintings and listening to string quartets and stuff like that. Very good education. Why am I saying this?
Because I asked you if you ever acted.
Sure.
Or wanted to be an actor.
And I decided pretty young that I should major in something that what was most interesting in school was extracurricular activities. And so I basically did that and barely got through each year in my classes. My first acting experience, I was at Lawrenceville, and I was 11, and my voice had not changed. And my first acting role, I played a middle-aged British matron. Not too many young playwrights can say that.
No.
And I liked that. I thought it was great fun. My voice changed, and I kept on acting. Maybe the major role that I played, pretty awful. Does anybody remember Maxwell Anderson?
Oh, yes.
Of course. He wrote one really, really terrible play called A Mask of Kings.
Oh, yes.
About the emperor in verse. Mm-hmm, yes. Long, long, long verse speeches. And about the Emperor Franz Joseph of Austria and his son, the Archduke Rudolf, and stuff leading up to, but not causing, the First World War. And we were putting that on at Trinity College. And I had the role of the Emperor Franz Joseph, and a good friend of mine had the role of the Archduke Rudolf. It was one of those plays in which those were the two good roles, and everybody else stood around with swords and spears watching us talk.
Yeah.
I did okay. I didn't remember any of my lines. I got thrown out of college a week after we opened. I don't think it was because of my acting.
No.
But I had an English teacher, a philosophy teacher, who was British. And he said to me, "Well, I watched you perform out there. You did a quality performance." And, you know, I was so happy. A quality performance. Yeah. Wow. And then I figured out what a British man meant by a quality performance, that I was capable of playing one or two qualities.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, that was the end of my acting career. I got thrown out of college, and I enjoyed it a lot. It was fun playing characters, but I never wanted to be a professional actor, though I'm not bad at reading.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think you read your own plays marvelously, and that's really why I asked you.
Well, that's because when I write them, I hear them and I see them.
Of course you do. Yeah. Of course you do. I cannot believe that an hour has passed. I looked at my watch because we're allowed to take some questions.
It hasn't. It's only 53 minutes.
I cannot believe that 53 hours have passed. No. If you would like to ask questions, but they have to be questions that Edward can answer. I mean, and that you can use the time well for, because it's precious, I think, even 53 minutes of it. And if you do ask, will you ask loudly enough so the rest of the audience can hear? Because I'm not very good at repeating people's questions. Okay.
I think this gentleman had his hand up first.
There you are.
No, the play is called Occupant, not The Occupant.
Oh,
it's all right.
And I know that you're doing a new production of it with Miss Sadie's role, and I was wondering, have you made many changes to it since the original production?
You should know a little bit about what happened with this play, Occupant, which is about Louise Nevelson, the great sculptor who was a good friend of mine. 5 years ago, I guess it's 5 years or 5.5 years ago, we went into production at the Signature Theater, with the play, with Annie Bancroft playing Nevelson. We got toward previews, and we began previews, and then Annie fell ill. And we never opened. And we closed down the production before it opened, and so it was never reviewed. And so this has given the play the longest rehearsal period probably of any play in American theater. And we're opening again in early June, I believe, at the Signature Theater with Mercedes Rule playing Nevelson. So it's been a very, very long rehearsal period. Have I rewritten it? What was wrong with it? Why would I do that? No, what I usually do, I think maybe I've cut a couple of sentences out. We all overwrite. And maybe during the first rehearsals, I cut a paragraph or two. But I wait a long time before I put a play down on paper, a long time, years sometimes. And I don't have to make as many revisions as a lot of playwrights seem to need to make. And also, the play I wrote, what, 5.5 years ago? I'm not quite the same person. And why would I let anybody else get in there? And change it around.
The other you.
Yeah,
yes,
the other
exactly.
Me. Yeah, but no, I haven't at this point changed it at all. I'm very anxious to see if it works on stage. I think it does.
I think one of the interesting things of being in a rehearsal with Edward is that the script is the play that you're going to do, and it isn't a question of everybody suggesting and changing, and also that the punctuation, we were talking about the rhythm of language before, that the punctuation, you don't put a second, but you do put pauses, and you do give a few hints, and they're wonderful words to me. When I was studying acting, they told me to cross out all the playwright's suggestions.
This merely adds a week and a half to the rehearsal time.
I don't believe that. I'm interested to what the playwright wants to say.
Yes.
You know, I think it's a
you
good
You do
thing.
Believe that taking out all the playwright's instructions adds a week and a half to rehearsal, do you not?
No.
You don't?
No, I don't.
No.
No,
yes, you
I
do.
Don't.
You don't understand what I'm saying. I learned so much about punctuation by studying classical music and learning the way a composer punctuates.
Yeah.
A quarter note and then a dotted quarter note.
Yeah.
The value of the time value of which is one half again as much as the quarter note, which relates to the fact that there is a time differentiation between a comma and a semicolon.
Yes.
And a playwright has to be able to hear that difference. And so that's why it's so important to learn so much from classical music. And also, I think the psychological structure of a play relates to some of the classical music forms also.
Oh, yours do. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Mr. Albee, to follow up on this punctuation, I'm the scripts librarian upstairs where we have some of your manuscripts. And I was wondering...
Including the ones I don't admit to, yes? The first play that I will admit to, really my first play, The Zoo Story. I was delivering telegrams for Western Union back then. That's how I earned my beer. And I liberated a huge typewriter from the Western Union Company. Being a Western Union typewriter, it only printed capital letters, which was interesting.
Oh, funny.
Yes. And I wrote The Zoo Story on that typewriter. But as soon as I possibly could, I became even more of a Luddite than I was. I'm a perfect Luddite now. I write by hand. Manuscript. I don't understand computers. I don't understand why anybody would do anything except write by hand. My problem is I write in a kind of shorthand. So unless I transcribe it myself within a couple of weeks after I've written it, I no longer quite remember what it is, which can make my plays far more experimental than I intended.
Yes, please.
I just apropos of going into the theater. A few years ago at the Princeton Club, Arthur Miller was talking, and during the question period, a woman said, "My daughter is thinking of becoming an actress," and he abruptly cut her off and said, "If she's thinking about becoming an actress, she should not be an actress." But my question to you is, I read that you wrote for Virginia Woolf in just a few weeks at a summer house that you had rented on Fire Island. Did you have the play all in your head so that you could have written so complex a play in just a few weeks?
Oh, I must have. Here's the thing. When people ask me, how long did it take you to write this play or that play, I can never give an answer. For the simple reason, I don't know when I started thinking about the play. Mm-hmm. I don't know when the play moved straight into my unconscious and started festering there. Yeah. I don't know when that began. I don't know how long the play resisted moving into my conscious mind. But eventually, I became aware of the fact that I had been thinking about a play or the reality of the characters' lives in the play. So I don't know how long it takes me to write a play. Writing them down on paper doesn't take me terribly long. The Zoo Story took, I think, maybe 2.5 weeks to write. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Perhaps, 3 months to write. I wait a long time. Once I'm aware of the fact that I have a playwright, in my head, and I'm trying to figure out who the people are and why they're there and why do I care, I wait a very long time. And I think I probably wait longer than just about any playwright before I'm willing to commit the play to paper. But by the time I commit it to paper, I know my characters so well, and I know their needs so well, and why they're there, I know it so well, that I can trust them to take over the job of writing.
Yeah.
And so I'm convinced that they are writing the play. So the play that I just finished, Me, Myself, and I, in Princeton this past spring, winter. How long did it take me to write that? I don't know. 8 years? Did it take the 2 months that it took to put it on paper? I'm not sure. I never know how to answer that question. I'm not a didactic playwright in the sense that I don't decide now I must write a play about this or that thing that I'm unhappy about and get some characters in there who could possibly carry the story. No, I find out why I'm writing my plays by writing them. And I discover, aha, that's what you had in mind. and that's why you're writing the play. I trust the unconscious a great deal. And I trust my characters. And that's why I don't make long précis of the play. I don't decide what's going to happen in each scene of the play before I write it. Because what if I'm wrong? What if the characters don't want to do that? So I trust them completely, and that allows them to be very three-dimensional, which is fortunate.
It's true.
Will there be a New York production of Me, Myself, and I?
I certainly hope so. I hope it will happen this next season. That's what we're aiming toward.
Yes.
Before you were talking about stage direction.
A little louder, darling.
You were talking about stage directions earlier. Do you know if there are published versions of your plays that have stage directions that are not yours originally, but may have come from stage manager's notes from another production, as I've been told in another place?
Most of the stage directions, if I've been having a happy work experience with the director, are not going to be very different from the ones that I intended, because the director is more concerned about getting the actors to be the characters, and my plays are not very structurally elaborate. There's not an awful lot of stuff happening. Somebody sits down, stands up, enters, exits, kills somebody, vomits, you know.
Sounds so easy, doesn't it? Why can't we do it?
So I don't recall that I've ever be published a text of my play that does not resemble my intention.
No, I don't think so. I think...
How about over here?
Yes.
three quick questions, please. Can you comment fair to regard the final scene as optimistic since the sun is rising? And finally, are you still stung by the Pulitzer controversy?
That's two questions. That's all right. The Pulitzer controversy, for those who have gone on to more important things in their memory, was the qualified jury, voted Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf the Pulitzer Prize the year that it was up for it. But the trustees of Columbia University, having decided that the play was, God knows what, too long, perhaps, or decided that the jurors should be ignored, and they didn't award the prize that year. So, you know, that's the way that sort of thing goes. Talking about the end of the movie of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the sun is rising, yes, but the sun is coming up also in the text, but not quite as much as it did in the film. I went out to Hollywood to see, first I should tell you, by the way, the cast they promised me. They promised me when I was out there talking to Mr. Warner, Jack Warner, I guess, I said, who you plan to put in this film of my play? He said, we're doing it with Betty Davis and James Mason, which was very interesting because at that point, Betty Davis was 52, as was Martha, and James Mason had always been 46, you know. So. And also, since the character Martha does an imitation of Betty Davis fairly early in Act One, it would have been wonderful to see the film with Betty doing a good imitation of herself, as opposed to some of the bad ones she did later in her career. But there's a thing called movie magic, and Richard and Elizabeth were fighting a lot, and they were famous for that. And so they got into the film. And Elizabeth certainly did her best acting in any film in that. Unfortunately, she was 20 years too young for the role, mm-hmm. even though they changed the age of the non-existent kid from 21 to 15. Didn't do any good. And Richard was too old for her. But two things bothered me about the film. The text was fine because there were lots of screenplays written by Ernest Lehman, who was the producer, by him. He wrote his own screenplays, which we kept turning down. Now, the actors said, no, we won't do this one. Or Mike Nichols said, no, we won't do that one. So they ended up going into rehearsal for 2 weeks as if it were a play, rehearsing the text of the play. And then they shot the film. With the exception of two sentences, which I did not write, the entire text of the film of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is my words. The two sentences that I did not write, which Mr. Lehman wrote himself and paid himself, I believe, $250,000, which comes to $125,000 a sentence, were, as you remember, at one point, in spite of the play, meant to be happening in one room all the time, being nice and claustrophobic, they decided to go to a roadhouse. Mm-hmm. I believe Mr. Lehman wrote the following sentence, something like, hey, let's go to the roadhouse. And then having gotten them there, he had to write another one, something like, hey, let's come back from the roadhouse. I didn't write those two sentences, but there they are in the film. But here are two interesting things. I was very puzzled when I went to see the film, even in a rough cut. This is important because there was no music at that point. But also, I was very puzzled. The film started, and I said, "Something's wrong. It's in black and white."
Oh.
I wrote it in color.
Oh.
That really puzzled me. Why is this in black and white? And then I realized that in those days, in the middle 60s, a serious film had to be in black and white.
Oh, God.
It couldn't be in color. A musical could be in color, or a comedy could be in color. But here's the interesting thing. I don't like movie music in plays. I don't like lighting design that tells helps psychologically too much. And certainly I don't believe strange music in a play. I don't know where it's coming from. If there's going to be music in a play, I want to know where it's coming from and why it's there. All of a sudden, in the movie of Virginia Woolf, especially at the very end, the last scene of the play, when the dawn is rising, pretty cold dawn, and they're there by themselves, having to deal with the exorcism of their non-existent child, they have about 12 exchanges, 2 and 3 words each, which are pretty tough and pretty cold. And that's what I wrote. I saw the rough cut of the film before the music had been added, and that scene was wonderful. It was tough, and it was exactly what I had intended. Then I went to see it in New York when they'd added the movie music, and that scene had become sentimental, and the dawn was rising far, far too much. And I learned a great deal of mistakes that can be made. And then I started listening to movie music, and I began to realize that movie music is in most movies to encourage us to respond in a certain way. Or you know, you have the before in a horror film, you have the strange music before something terrible is going to happen. And they don't let us alone. They try to guide our reactions in a way that I don't think is fair. If you ever get a chance to see that film without the movie music, you'd have a much better experience, because it was a good, tough film. And I'm afraid the movie music sort of screwed it up for me.
Yeah. Alex North won the Oscar for the music, did he not?
I don't recall. That will tell you something about Oscars, perhaps. I'm sure. No, he was a very skillful composer, Ernest Newman. Yes, very, very.
Alex North.
No, was it Alex North? Oh, well, he was a very skillful film composer. But I just thought the music was totally unnecessary, and got in the way of the audience having the kind of tough experience that I had wanted them to have at the end of the film. But nobody said, hey, we're putting movie music in this. You know, if they said that, I would have said, maybe we should talk about it.
About one or two more questions then, because you have to go home to your dinners, don't you? Feed the dog and all that. Yes. We can't hear your question.
Louder, please stand up.
Please.
We will repeat it.
What does African tribal art mean for
yourself? What does African tribal art mean to me? Well, I think I've had the same experience that Picasso and Braque had in 1909, somewhat later, when the Musée de l'Homme opened in Paris, and everybody, the artists in Paris in 1909, were seeing the first African art they'd ever seen. And it changed the visual arts. It changed Cubism, for example. It was an amazing experience for the artists, and they began collecting. I have noticed, my walls are covered with stuff that interests me, mostly abstract paintings and a good deal of African sculpture. I find they relate beautifully. I find that they complement each other in very interesting ways. And so I've accumulated an awful lot of African art over the years because I like to look at good stuff. And what interests me most about African art, perhaps, even though it is some of the finest art I've ever seen, what interested me most about it is that none of it was made as art. It was all made for utilitarian and ceremonial purposes. None of it was made in this thing we call fine art. But
or
there it is.
Bought and sold.
Yeah, it is as much fine art as the people like Picasso who learned from it.
Exactly.
Absolutely extraordinary.
It is.
Yeah.
I think we should say good night to you and thank you for being a wonderful audience.